The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Rosch, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Susan L. Siegel presiding.
Good morning and welcome, everybody. Sorry we're getting off to a little bit of a slow start. I think we're all adjusting to there will be a winter in Minnesota after all. I was telling my colleagues that I heard a noise. I thought a roof was falling in. It took me a while to realize, no, that's a snowplow, because I haven't heard one since for a few months. All right, with that, I'm sure you're all old hands at remote oral arguments by now, but we will make an audio recording that will be available online after this calendar is completed. And so please, when you start, introduce yourself. And as you also know, each side has 15 minutes and then 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant. And with that, Mr. Bradford, please go ahead.
Thank you, Judge Siegel, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford. I represent the appellant, 7 Acquisition LLC, which is the tenant of the commercial property at issue. This court should reverse the district court and send the disputed rent claim to arbitration. As you know, there are two primary issues before the court. The first is whether a court-appointed receiver is bound by mandatory arbitration clauses in a pre-existing commercial lease it seeks to enforce against the tenant. And the second issue is whether the tenant may assert the common law defense of recoupment in response to the receiver's demand for rent under the lease. I don't intend to spend too much time today on the second issue, recoupment, because that issue is really one for the arbitrators. And in any event, Minnesota law is quite clear that any defense, good against the original corporation, 700 Hennepin in this case, is also good against the receiver. That's the Magnuson case from the Minnesota Supreme Court. Simply put, Your Honors, assets that are not property of a defunct entity do not become assets of a defunct entity simply because a receiver is appointed. So let me turn to what we believe is the core issue before the court today, and that's the arbitration issue. The district court's reasoning in denying arbitration was simply that the receiver is not a party to the commercial lease that contains the arbitration clause. The fundamental problem with the district court's reasoning is that the receiver's attempt to collect rent under the lease, according to the district court, is not derived from the lease itself, but from the receivership order. That rationale is repeated in the very first sentence of respondent's brief under its argument section. Fundamentally, that is wrong. What that does is it confuses the receiver's standing to pursue 7 under the commercial lease. It confuses that with the party's substantive rights and obligations once that claim is asserted. The receiver has no greater rights and no fewer obligations than the contracting party whose rights it is asserting under the contract. The receivership order gives the receiver standing to pursue relief under the lease. We don't dispute that. It gives the receiver standing to pursue relief under a contract to which it is otherwise a stranger. The contract, though, defines the party's substantive rights and obligations. The receiver must take the contracts as it finds them. This is well-rooted in statute, Minnesota Statute 576.45, Subdivision 1, states quite clearly that a receiver, quote, succeeds to all of the rights and duties of the respondent, that's 700 Hennepin, under any executory contract. That sentence couldn't be more clear. And the statute goes on to define executory contract to include an ongoing lease. That is precisely the situation we have here. We also have the fact that it's very clear by the receivership order and case law that when the receiver attempts to enforce another party's contract, it stands in that party's shoes when it comes to enforcing the contract. This is in the receivership order, addendum page 44, gives the receiver the power to enforce any valid term, condition, or covenant of any existing lease. In other words, the receiver steps into the shoes of 700 Hennepin, to enforce the lease. The receivership order gives the receiver the power to operate the property, to collect rent, and all kinds of other things that are typically associated with what the landlord would do. And this is our point. When the receiver is attempting to collect rent, he's acting as the landlord would and seeking to enforce the landlord's rights. A determination of what rent is owed, if any, to the receivership entity must be determined by arbitration pursuant to the contract. And finally, the district court's decision is error because it is contrary to virtually every other jurisdiction that has considered this issue. While we appreciate those jurisdictions are not binding, their rationale is quite persuasive and it's almost uniform. The Oman decision from Iowa, the Medeiros decision from Oklahoma, the Javits decision from the Sixth Circuit, ISP from Indiana, and so on. And those cases are cited in our brief. Instead, the district court relied on two plainly distinguishable decisions, notably Nelson, which distinguished the case because the contract there was entered into after the receiver was appointed, which is not our case. Let me address just what I understand to be the two core points in response that the receiver has raised. Number one is the applicability of the arbitration clause in the contract in terms of whether it even applies to a rent dispute. And then the second is the breadth of the statute in terms of the district court's jurisdiction, which is 576.23. With respect to the applicability of the arbitration clause, Judge Regis, in the initial action between 700 Hennepin and my client, already concluded that the lease is clear and unambiguous in providing for arbitration of lease disputes. That's at addendum pages 15 and 34. And of course, the receiver itself, after being appointed, invoked paragraph 60 of the lease at addendum page 64. And that section of the lease is captioned arbitration procedures. The district court here at addendum page 3 characterized this as a, quote, dispute over non-payment of rent. Paragraph 35 of the lease defines tenant default to include failure to pay rent. So what we have here is a disputed tenant default. And then paragraph 36 defines the landlord's remedies in response to a tenant default. Now, my friend on the other side says those remedies are really limited to taking possession of the property or terminating the lease. But with respect, that disregards the very last paragraph of that section, which says no right or remedy herein conferred upon or reserved to landlord is intended to be exclusive of any other right or remedy herein. And all of the remedies that are provided in that section apply in the event of a tenant default. And the contract is quite clear that a disputed rent claim is subject to arbitration. The last point I want to make is with respect to the statute. There is an argument that 576.23 confers on the district court exclusive jurisdiction over this dispute. And our position, Your Honors, is that that is simply a misreading of 576.23. We do not dispute that 576.23 confers jurisdiction on the district court over the receiver and over receivership property. In other words, when there is indisputably receivership property, the court has in rem jurisdiction over that property.
If I could jump in with a question. Can you address the otherwise argument that was raised, that subdivision one of 576.45 has a qualifier, which is unless the district court states otherwise, and the argument is that in this case, the district court did state otherwise.
Yeah, and if you read the sentence where that argument is made, Judge Ross, what they cite to is what they say is the district court concluded otherwise in the rent order. In other words, in the order directing the party and my client to pay rent to the receiver. In my view, Judge Ross, that is circular reasoning by respondent, because what it does is it takes the district court's order that simply says a receiver is not bound by arbitration clauses in existing contracts. And it reads that as saying that this receiver is, that there's been a determination that this receiver is not bound by the plain language in the statute. The district court's reasoning was simply that the receiver is not a party to the contract, where the statute says the receiver succeeds to all of the rights and liabilities. So there was not any independent reasoning in the rent order to explain why the court was not following the plain language of the statute. And of course, there's no finding in the district court's order that the statute is somehow inapplicable. The court simply found that as a general proposition, receivers are not bound by arbitration clauses in the contracts they seek to enforce without court approval. And the problem with that is what the court approval is referring to is contracts that are entered into after the receiver is appointed. In that case, it makes sense to have court authority. And of course, in this case, Your Honor, the core point here is there has been no finding, zero, that my client has any assets that belong to the receivership estate. Until that happens, until there is a finding that we have, that we hold receivership property, the district court simply has no jurisdiction and cannot override the arbitration clause in the contract at issue. Unless there,
can I interrupt with a question? Yes. So the lease does have a clause in it talking about how the lease is subject to the mortgage. So is that at all relevant here? I mean, No. Neither side raised that, so I'm going to assume the answer is no. But
well, the respondents did raise that clause in their response brief, and we did address it in our reply very briefly. And what that clause basically says is we acknowledge that there is an existing mortgage. What that doesn't say is if the mortgagor retains or gets a receiver appointed, that it somehow trumps the arbitration clause in the agreement. It just doesn't say that.
And I guess what I meant is that the mortgage itself is not in the, is it, there's no clause in the mortgage that was called out, correct? Saying we disavow any arbitration clauses or any recoupment defenses of any lessee.
Correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Okay. No. I didn't. Yeah. I you answered the question correctly the way it was phrased. I wasn't being very clear. Okay.
But to be clear, and I think this is where you're going, the receiver never invoked any portion of the mortgage as saying that somehow absolves us of the arbitration clause in the commercial lease we're seeking to enforce.
Okay.
Which my client wasn't a party to the mortgage agreement, so it wouldn't be bound by that in any event. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll yield the balance of my time. Thank you.
Any questions? I don't see any. All right. Please go ahead, Mr. Capping, is that the right pronunciation?
That's right. That's okay. Right, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
May it please the court, Michael Capping on behalf of the respondent receiver. I just want to take a step back to talk about why we're here today. The receiver was appointed in September of 2020 and was given the limited task of operating the building that secured the lender's loan. This is not a general receivership over an entity. The receiver did not become the borrower in the situation. It is merely operating a mortgaged building. So with that, from day one, Seven had refused to pay rent into the receivership estate despite occupying.
So if I could interrupt you just for a minute. Just so the receiver operates under instruction of the district court, correct?
Correct.
And the district court has to operate within the laws of the state of Minnesota, correct?
Correct.
So what would authorize the district court to issue an order ignoring a portion of a negotiated, agreed upon contract.
Min stat 576.23, which gives the receivership court exclusive jurisdiction over the receiver. And on top of that, as...
But that's over the receiver, correct? And isn't correct. There, if you look at 576.22, that talks about the applicability of the chapter in common law, isn't there a provision in there, D, that says that all other law applies unless it's explicitly displaced by this chapter?
Yes.
And so how do we read those suits? So what would give the receiver of the district court the right then to ignore, under this receivership statute, the right to ignore a lease provision unless the lease was somehow invalid, which I don't think, I mean, that's not what you're claiming, is that this is suddenly turned into some kind of tenancy in common and the lease, it's not a lease. I mean, this is under the lease, correct? I guess is all I'm trying to say.
Correct. I guess the more specific authority would be 576.45, which gives the receiver authority over executory contracts. The district court can terminate them completely, or, as we mentioned earlier, can order otherwise that the receiver...
I don't mean to be difficult here, but what... Because I'm trying to understand your argument. Or the basis for your argument. I understand your argument. I want to understand the legal basis for it. So what you're arguing is that the receivership statute gives the court and thereby the receiver authority to ignore common law contract. I mean, is that your argument? And then where's your authority for that?
I wouldn't say ignore so much as Minnesota statute 576.23, which was issued before this lease was entered into, would trump that arbitration provision.
Well, but that statute doesn't, the chapter doesn't say it trumps common law contract, does it? As a matter of fact, I think it says the opposite in 576.22. Is there something in point, you know, I mean, that's why I'm just trying to understand how what gives the district court that authority? I know you're relying on the statute. Is there anything else besides the language of 0.45?
Yes.
And 0.23?
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
Lease section 31 provides that the tenant accepts the lease subordinate to any mortgage. Now, the receiver isn't a party to the mortgage.
So is there a provision in the mortgage? Because tell me if Mr. Bradford said that no provision in the mortgage was called out at the district court. So is there a specific provision in the mortgage that you're relying on?
No.
Or that's in the record even? Yeah.
Well, I suppose theoretically it's in the record. The point there is that the receiver was appointed pursuant to the lender's mortgage rights. So that the lender put a receiver in place per its rights under the mortgage, and the lease recognizes that the lender can do that. So the receivership statute rights that come along with that receivership are senior to whatever rights that the tenant might have under the lease, is the point there.
But there's no specific provision that you're relying on in that mortgage. So in bankruptcy court, a mortgagor clearly would have, you know, greater interest than the debt that the arbitrator owed. I mean, that is not a ruling. That's a hypothetical, because the issue is not before us. But a secured creditor has a superior interest in bankruptcy, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But then that's not what we're dealing with here, though.
Well, we're dealing with the receiver that was put in place by a secured lender.
Right. And then is there something in Minnesota statutes that would say we can ignore the provisions of a lease because you're a secured creditor? Okay. And where is that? Is there anything outside of Chapter 576?
I haven't looked outside of 576.45. No,
okay. Continue. Oh, sorry, Judge Larkin.
Thank you. I have a question. This is a big picture question. I need you to put this in context for me. What I'm struggling with is this. You represent the mortgagor, the receiver trying to protect the rights of the mortgagor. And I mean, I assume there is nothing in the mortgage that said Seven couldn't lease out this property, did so. A court has found that in favor and against Seven on a breach of lease claim, and there's a judgment. I mean, if the receiver is going to take the position that, well, we're entitled to collect rent under the terms of the lease agreement, doesn't the receiver have to step into the lease agreement as it's been applied and found to be by the district court? I mean, I'm not understanding how the district court can say tenant had a right not to pay rent, and then yet tenant's obligated to pay rent under the very same lease just because a receiver is asking for it on behalf of the mortgagor as opposed to the landlord. I mean, don't you have to take the property as you find it, and as which would include the interpretation and judgments related to any lease interests on the property?
And is this getting more into the arbitration provision compared to recoupment, Judge Larkin?
Yeah,
maybe both.
I'm sorry, and I'm trying to say big picture issue, but I'm obviously confused. I just don't understand why a district court judgment interpreting the lease and saying who's obligated to pay and who is not binding on anyone who comes into court attempting to collect under the very same lease on behalf of the person against whom the district court has ruled.
Yep, that makes sense. Big picture, this is a limited receivership over mortgaged asset. Every single case cited by the appellant deals with a receiver over an entity. So yes, in that situation, you do step into the shoes of the entity.
Okay.
But the second point, and I hate to keep going back to 576, but again, big picture, we have a receivership court here who is responsible for overseeing the receiver and the receivership property. Minnesota statute obligates Judge Jamie Anderson to do that. What happened at the district court was Seven was saying, Judge, abrogate your statutory obligation and your exclusive authority and kick the receiver into arbitration. And I think the point of the statute is you can't just carve off a little piece, in this case, a very significant piece of the receivership estate and send it over to an arbitrator. The whole point of the receivership statute is that this judge is monitoring the entire asset as a whole. And I think the statute's pretty clear.
What is the asset? The asset's the building, right?
Just the building, yep.
Well, how does the asset include lease payments?
Yes, pursuant to the lease. That's how you calculate the rent is set forth in the lease. Is that what you're asking?
Well, I understand that. But I mean, there's the physical building. That's your asset.
Yep.
What makes a rent payment under the lease an asset that's subject to the receivership?
Minnesota statute. That's in 576 as well.
But then if a judge has said that the landlord is not entitled to those rent payments, how can the receiver attempt to collect them?
I don't think no judge has ever said that. The Seven has an existing judgment against the property owner, and this kind of gets into the recoupment issue. Before the receivership was even in place, they exercised the remedy and got a right. money judgment. That's passed. What the receiver requested in this case is rent moving forward. It's obviously due anew every month. And that's a receivership asset. I'm not trying to collect assets that or rent that existed before the receivership. That I can't do that. And to close the loop on the arbitration provision, at a minimum, we can rely on just the plain language and your traditional analysis of whether an arbitration provision applies. Section 36 says, upon the occurrence of a tenant default, the landlord may elect to either cancel and terminate this lease, or two, terminate tenant's right of possession only. And then we go on to see where it talks about this same section 36. If the tenant disputes in good faith that a tenant default exists, landlord shall not exercise any of its remedies provided herein, but shall, as its sole and exclusive remedy, proceed to arbitration. The receiver was not exercising a remedy under the lease in this case. It's not, it did not request that Judge Anderson terminate the lease or evict, otherwise evict the tenant. What we said is, Judge, we're under your exclusive authority. Tenant says they don't have to pay because they have this recoupment defense. Can you please issue an order on this issue? And she did. That wasn't a remedy under the lease. This was guidance from the receivership court, who has exclusive authority over the receiver.
What is your position as to whether we should issue a precedential rather than a non-precedential opinion? And if precedential, what is the rule of law that you would ask us to issue?
I don't think it's necessary to issue a precedential order in this case. It's dependent on the language of the specific lease and the unique relief sought by the receiver in this case.
I thought it didn't depend on the specific language of the lease. I thought you're saying it depended just on Chapter 576.
Well, I have four independent arguments. One would be the statute says it's exclusive authority.
Okay, I understand. Okay, I don't continue on.
Yeah. Can I take another shot at my question then?
Yes.
Thank you for explaining it. So if you're seeking to recover under the terms of the lease and you're in the shoes of the landlord and the lease requires the landlord to go to arbitration, if the tenant says, I don't think I have to pay, why aren't you required to go? Why are you in a better position than the landlord would have been on this issue when it comes to arbitration?
I am in no better situation than the landlord in this case. If the landlord went to the court and said, and sought some sort of declaratory judgment as to whether recoupment applies, that's not exercising a remedy under the lease. And it's certainly not exercising the two remedies specifically identified in section 36 of the lease. I think that's the easiest way out of this. It's just, even assuming I'm subject to the lease, it still doesn't, the arbitration provision still doesn't apply for the narrow issue presented to the court.
That's helpful.
So can I ask you a quick question here about the arbitration clause? We're dealing with a tenant default here, right? And so the tenant has a right to submit it to arbitration under paragraph 37. Oh, landlord default. Okay, I see what you're saying. So could the tenant, well, maybe that's more a question for Mr. Bradford. Okay, I take that back.
And if I can bounce over to the recoupment issue real quick. Again, some of the same issues identified before. Well, first of all, stepping back for the standard review, it's an equitable remedy and the district court is reviewed for abuse of discretion. And this is on top of the district court's discretion to do what is best for all concerned in any receivership proceeding. Under your traditional recoupment analysis, 7 should not be entitled to apply it because it is not the same transaction. They have an existing money judgment. There is no outstanding claim. They're not trying to recover a claim against either the receiver or the building owner. That's already been reduced to judgment. And 2, Section 31 of the lease says it is subject to and subordinate to all mortgages. Therefore, the receiver's right to collect comes first. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your arguments, and hope we weren't giving you too much of a hard time. Mr. Bradford, at the beginning, is this a landlord default or is this a tenant default? And what difference does that make in terms of the arbitration clause?
Thank you, Your Honor. You predicted my first point. I do want to make 2 points and then get to Judge Ross's question about precedential versus non-precedential. In response to your question, Judge Siegel, I actually had my thumb on the correct page. There are 2 paragraphs, 2 clauses of the lease that have remedies sections. One is paragraph 36 and one is paragraph 37. We're worried about 36, which is remedies of landlord upon the occurrence of a tenant default. And again, tenant default is defined as the failure to pay rent in the preceding paragraph, paragraph 35. So there's no question that this case involves an alleged tenant default, which is consistent with what the district court said at addendum page 3. This is a rent dispute. And the notion that arbitration only applies if the landlord is attempting to cancel or terminate the lease or terminate the tenant's right of possession is contrary to the plain language of the entirety of paragraph 36, which does identify those two remedies at the beginning, but then goes on to state in the last paragraph, third to last. right or remedy is exclusive. So it's very clear, as Judge Regis found, and the district court made no finding, by the way, that this arbitration clause doesn't apply to the dispute. It simply said it doesn't apply to the receiver because it's not a party to this contract. Obviously, that holding would have been unnecessary had the arbitration clause not applied in the abstract. The other point I wanted to make is we are not trying to abrogate the statute, and we're not asking the court to abrogate the statute. We're asking the court to apply it. And what 576.23 says is that the court has jurisdiction over receivership property. The whole point of the dispute that we're having is Seven is claiming we don't hold any receivership property because all of it is subject to a recoupment defense. We don't owe rent to the original landlord. How could we owe rent to you, the receiver? You don't get any greater rights than the property owner simply by having a receiver appointed. One other provision of the receivership order that I was remiss in not pointing out in my opening remarks, but it's consistent with this point, is on addendum page 46, and it's paragraph 7 of the receivership order. And what that says is all third parties, so that would be Seven, all third parties that are obligated to the respondent, that's 700 Hennepin, are hereby directed to make payments directly to the receiver. So consistent with the statute, what this order says is there has to be a determination, an initial determination, that Seven is obligated to the receiver before it's obligated under this order to make payments to the receiver. That's where the arbitration clause kicks in, because the contracting parties agreed in order to determine if the tenant is obligated to the landlord, an arbitrator has to make that decision. And finally, with respect to Judge Ross's question about the nature of the opinion, what I would say is if you affirm, it should be a non-precedential decision because you're not cutting new ground with your decision. If you reverse, it should not be precedential because you're simply enforcing the plain language of the statute. If you were to affirm, with all respect, you would be the first court to hold that a receiver is not bound by arbitration clauses in a pre-existing contract. If that's the holding, that should be in a precedential decision. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
All right. Any further questions for Mr. Bradford? Nope. Seeing none, I want to thank both of you for your arguments. The case is now submitted.